Try not to do that. So, well, welcome for the first of six lectures under the title No Free Pizza. And if you remember the email that I sent out to you, I said there's no book, there's no preparation, but there's also no free pizza. So the only thing that I'm going to offer you are some ideas that will probably be new to you, and they might be a little bit challenging to think through, but make the effort. And I'll talk about this a little bit tomorrow with the OCF. When I went to college, being introduced to big ideas was something that was really quite helpful for my own faith. I realized just how narrow my vision of what it was to be a Christian was. I wasn't a bad guy, it just was narrow. Hi! How are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. And send more paper, yeah. I'm also going to record this for the seminary because they want content. But we always need more content. So what we're going to do is I'm going to talk for about 15 minutes, and then the last half hour, 45 minutes are questions. And that's actually one of the reasons you have that paper in front of you, so that you can see what some of the ideas are, and you can go back to them. And I really like questions. And usually when I do more formal presentations, the thing I always like to remind people is that I've been looking at this stuff for a really long time, and frankly, I'm bored. The only thing new for me is you. Everything here is something just been doing for a long time. So I'm looking forward to your questions, and make them challenging. But I'm going to go in with two challenging questions for you. And the first one is, why is there something rather than nothing? And the second one is, what are you going to do about it? Now, the spirituality of the Orthodox Church is built on the answers to these two questions. And to help us understand the questions and especially the answers and what that might mean for us, we're going to look at the 7th century monk, St. Maximus the Confessor. What I especially like about St. Maximus is his argument that Christ's incarnation was not a reaction to sin, but God's original plan to unite all creation. This plan is something that God is not something that God does for us or to us, but rather it's something that God does with us. And as part of that, he created us as a microcosm. And that means we're sort of the whole of creation in miniature. And as a microcosm, we are called by God to unite the five fundamental dimensions or parts of reality. And I'll explain what those are in a minute. We'll also see in a little bit, we failed in this. But Christ succeeds in uniting the cosmos in his person, and he invites us to take up the work that really was always ours from the beginning. One of the things that's interesting about the gospel, at least from one point of view, is that what Christ asks from each of us is simply to be who God created us to be. In other words, to be what Thomas Merton called your true self, and just be who God made you. The challenge, and we'll see this as we go through the subsequent lectures, is that I generally don't know who I am. And that's not, by the way, a function of being 18. It's just something that we struggle with throughout our entire life. Most of my work with people when they come for confession and spiritual direction and that stuff is just to get them to understand themselves. But anyway, the life of the church is nothing more or less than our accepting this invitation to unite creation and experiencing this in our own life. And experiencing in our own life Christ's communion with the cosmos. In the theology of the church, this experience of communion is called deification. So are you ready? That's an introduction. The introductions will get shorter as time goes on. So let's start with St. Maximus the Confessor's big idea about the universe. about humanity and Christ and about Christ's purpose. No, and wait till I'm done. All right. You should know up front that while these ideas are old, they're new to most Christians. In fact, they're so new that they honestly sound like something out of a science fiction or a fantasy novel. I remember talking with a group of Christian mental health professionals, and I talked about some of these ideas, and they thought I was a Mormon. And I had to go back and explain to them, I'm not. We're just using some similar language, or they're using similar language. But anyway, this is something out of science fiction or fantasy novel, but they are really big, hard ideas. And if you let them, they'll change how you understand not only Christianity, but also yourself. You know, I've already given you a hint as to what the answer is to the question, why is there something rather than nothing? But let's start with that question, because it helps us get to the heart of Christian belief. We usually think we know exactly why Christ had to become human, right? Well, Maximus tells us to take a step back and think about it for a second. He asks us to consider the possibility that even if Adam and Eve had never sinned, if everything had gone perfectly in the garden, God still would have become man. You know, most of us are taught that, no, this isn't right. That the reason of the incarnation is because we messed up. He's the divine rescue plan, the divine rescue mission. He came basically because I'm a bad person. But what if that's not what happened? What if the incarnation was motivated by something other than human failure of our messing up? And here you have it, Maximus's answer to the question. For him, the incarnation, God becoming human in Jesus Christ, was always the plan. It was always going to happen. It wasn't some reaction to our failure. The incarnation, God becoming human in Jesus Christ, was the goal from before time began. So why is there something rather than nothing? So that God could become man. The incarnation is the whole reason there is something rather than nothing, and this really is the key point. And for Maximus, our sin is, while real, it's just a subplot. It's a blip in a much bigger story. The main plot, the main purpose, was always God's desire to unite everything in creation to himself by becoming a part of that creation. And you get a hint of this if you read the book of Genesis. God strolls in the garden in the cool of the evening. The Father saw that as a hint that God really had intended to walk among us as one of us. But again, the incarnation isn't the backup plan. It isn't a response to human failure. There's nothing shameful in the story of God becoming human. It was, in fact, the entire reason the universe was made in the first place. To wrap your head around why this was the master plan, we've got to understand how Maximus saw the cosmos and the role we're called to play in creation. Maximus looks at everything around him and saw it had five fundamental distinctions. And for those of you who go on to study philosophy somewhere, you'll actually get this idea of distinctions in Aristotle, who I love more than is probably helpful, but it's true. The first and absolute biggest distinction is between the created and the uncreated and the created, between God and everything else. That's the first big overarching distinction. Then inside creation, you've got the distinction between what's intelligible and what's sensible, between ideas and things that we know with our senses, or between immaterial and material things. This is the difference between love and physical attraction. Love is immaterial. It's intelligible. Attraction is physical. It's visual. Then there's the distinction between the heavens and the earth, and paradise and the inhabited world. For Maximus, the world as it was created was actually paradise, and it included the material world. So the world that we live in now, is not the world as it was meant to be. It's something else. The last distinction is between male and female. The visible world, or what he called the sensible world, human society, and men and women are the dimensions of reality studied by the natural and human sciences. So almost everyone in the college group is a STEM major. So you study the material world, and it is good that you do so. But there's another world that's not material, that's immaterial. The material world, the sensible world, is also, as we'll see, the part of reality that keeps fracturing into separate pieces. You need only pay attention to people's dating lives. That male-female distinction just often shatters. So again, where do we fit into this picture? Like I said, Maximus says that each person is a microcosm. Basically, we are the whole cosmos, the whole of reality in miniature, and humanity is totally unique in this. We live at the crossroads of the uncreated and the created, of the spiritual and the material dimensions. We just don't talk about it. But you have this sense of the existence of God. You have this sense that there's something more important than what you can see. And that inspires you. You know, and the reason, though, that we have these often conflicting feelings is that we have a material body and an immaterial soul, which means we are really the bridge between the physical and spiritual worlds. We're the glue that's meant to hold everything together. And there's something else. This isn't just an abstraction or an interesting fact about what it means to be human. As Maximus sees it, this is your personal job description. It's your vocation. It's your calling. It's your purpose in life. It means that all the things that you do to acquire the knowledge for a profession or a trade, it's important, but it's only part of the story. You see, each of us has a work that only we can do, and that means that each of us is called to be a priest of creation. And what that means is that it's our job to bring these different things that are often in conflict into harmony with each other, and then to offer them to God. So that's the job, to unite the uncreated and the created, the material and the immaterial, to unite heaven and earth and the whole human family. That's what it means to be human. So if the first answer to the first question is, why is there something rather than nothing so that God can become man? The answer to the second question, and what are you going to do about it? Well, I'm going to bring things together. I'm going to make harmony. I'm going to work to create harmony and communion. The thing of it is, we only need to look around to see that this grand cosmic project just hasn't happened. It's been derailed. For St. Maximus, this is the only real tragedy in human life. To be a sinner, which is what we're talking about here, doesn't mean that I do bad things, though I do bad things. To be a sinner means that the good things I do are never quite good enough. So instead of doing my one job of uniting the whole cosmos, I do the opposite. I create even more division, beginning with myself. And again, you know this experience. There are two or three things that you want to do at any given time, and whatever you do sort of always leaves you a little unsatisfied for the things that you left undone. And it isn't just me that does this. Even though we want to do otherwise, we tend to leave the universe more broken than we found it. Think what happens whenever you make a decision. Being here now means that there are all sorts of other places that you could be, but aren't. So saying yes to being here means that you made a whole almost infinite number of no's. Every yes conceals within it a negation, a no. What I'm describing here, yes, it's opportunity cost for the economists in the room. What I'm describing here, though, is the fall that we read about in the first chapters of the Bible. In the Orthodox Church, just real quick as an aside, there are two different takes on Adam and Eve before the fall. One view is pretty straightforward. That's primarily from Augustine. He says the first humans were created as mature adults, given their mission, and they failed. They dropped the ball, leaving creation in a worse state. The other one, and the more radical view, and this is the one from St. Maximus, is that that Adam and Eve, while physically mature, were spiritually infants. They were meant to grow into their vocation as priests of creation. In this view, which goes all the way back to St. Irenaeus in the second century, their failure was more like that of a child who acts out of ignorance than malice. And this, I think, is really important because we tend to see people do bad things and think they must, by virtue of that fact, be bad people. Well, mostly we do bad things because, as my mom would say, oh, honey, they're just dumb. We don't know any better. In either case, the world we experience is kind of a false world. It's not the real creation God intended because humanity failed its mission. But our failure, real though it is, doesn't mean that God's original plan for unity has been derailed. Remember, for St. Maximus and St. Irenaeus, we were created to learn by trial and error. This means the problem isn't the error, but the failure to learn from our mistakes. On the Sunday before the beginning of Great Lent, there's a marvelous hymn where we hear about Adam sitting outside the gates of paradise weeping for his sin. And the hymn goes on to tell us that had Adam only repented when God asked, Adam, where are you? And who told you you were naked? Everything would have continued along the way it was meant to continue. The problem isn't that Adam sinned, is that Adam didn't learn from his failure. He didn't repent. And this is where Christ steps into the story. Not as plan B, but as the one who was always meant to be the ultimate unifier. God's solution wasn't to scrap the whole project and start over. Not at all. From the beginning, the plan was for God to enter into the creation and finish the job from inside when we were mature enough to cooperate with Him. You may have discovered as you grow older, or some of us are growing older faster than others, along the way, your parents gave you new responsibility, new privileges. It's much the same way with God. God became the perfect human being, the ultimate microcosm, and together with us now as mature human beings, able to freely partner with God, brings our original cosmic purpose to completion. This is what God is doing. In the life of the church, Christ heals all five distinctions, which because of sin have now become sources of division. As both God and man, He unites the created and the uncreated. In His human nature, He has both a body and a soul, and so is able in a human way to bridge the material and the immaterial. Through His death and resurrection, He pulls heaven and earth back together, finally achieving humanity's original mission. Maximus gives us this really beautiful image to grasp all this. He says, to think of a circle and all the different principles that make up creation, what he calls the logi, as different lines, as the radii spread out from the center. Creation is a symphony of diversity. Every part of creation is unique, but they all find their single point of origin, their unity at that one point in the center, and that center is the Logos, Christ Himself. Another church father, St. Isaac the Syrian, uses a similar image. He says that human beings are like spokes on a wheel. The closer we are to the rim, the further we are from each other. But when we draw closer to Christ, who is the hub, we also draw closer to each other. And this isn't just that we draw closer to each other. When we draw closer to Christ, we become able to fulfill our vocation as priests of creation. When we draw closer to Christ, we bring the creation with us and so bring creation into a deeper communion with Christ. When you come to liturgy on Sunday and you're praying, it's easy to overlook the fact that it's not just your prayers that you bring, but you bring your heart. You bring all the people who are a part of you. And when you stand before God, they stand with you. So, Christ has accomplished this cosmic reconciliation, but what does it mean for us right now when we're coming to the home stretch here, kids? Well, this brings up the ultimate goal, the absolute end game of the whole cosmic drama, deification. The belief that we are called to participate in God's own divine nature. Through grace, we can become everything that God is. Now, that doesn't mean that we become God. It means that we are totally filled with His divine life and energy. St. Irenaeus says to be in Christ is to be like a piece of iron in fire. The iron takes on the quality of fire, heat, light, while remaining what it is, iron. Likewise, the Christian takes on the qualities of God. Holiness, freedom, creativity, patience, kindness, compassion, forgiveness, and love without ever ceasing to be human. So how on earth does this happen in our lives? Maximus uses the phrase perichoresis, a Greek word meaning dance. It means that God and humanity move together in a perfect union held together by mutual love. In this union, neither one is destroyed or consumed by the other. It's a divine dance. And like a dance, there's room for creativity. God's grace isn't imposed on us. Rather, grace is an invitation to freely cooperate with God. It's an invitation to use our unique talents and gifts as we grow in intimacy with Him. And the intimacy of this union is amazing. It's just not a little piece of us connecting with God. It's our entire being, our whole self being, completely permeated by the entire being of God. This is one of the reasons why in the Old Testament, the relationship between God and Israel is always referred to as a conjugal union. It's like a marriage between a man and a woman. For Maximus, this is not just some abstract philosophical idea. He says that this deifying dance happens most tangibly, most concretely in the life of the church, especially in the Eucharist, where each of us is transformed into another Christ, making us gods by grace. St. Augustine puts it this way, when I eat the cow becomes me. When I eat the body of Christ, I become Him. Because the greater always subsumes into itself the lesser. So let's zoom out, and I'm going to finish up here as quick as I can. It's important to keep in mind that when Maximus was talking in the 7th century, his ideas were part of a pretty diverse intellectual landscape. His views were really different from a lot of what was out there. He was pushing back against Greek philosophers who, like some scientists today, believed matter was eternal, that it was never created. At the same time, he was also criticizing those then who, like some Christians today, argued for a very literal six-day creation and a young earth. For all these differences, the creationists and the pagans really saw reality as static and tended to be suspicious of human freedom and creativity. And that leads us to the final and maybe the most crucial takeaway from all this. This story isn't over. Christ has accomplished the reconciliation in principle, but we, you and me, we're called to be active participants in this unfinished cosmic work. Through our faith, through loving our neighbor, through the life of the church, we are actually continuing the great project of uniting the universe. So I'll leave you with this question to chew on, and we'll come back to it in the next 5 classes. How does everything change if we start to see our purpose not just as our own individual salvation, but as joining with Christ in the healing and the deification of the entire cosmos? But for now, it's a guy writing in the 7th century who had things to say to us, and I think that is delightful. So, I talked longer than I expected. I apologize. So, your turn.